Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 11th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's turn first to the weather forecast for today, this coming from KCRG-TV. Some showers and storms today, more widespread tonight. A slow-moving storm system will pass through the central United States in the next few days, giving us repeated chances for rain and storms. Many areas are expecting frost or freeze conditions again this morning, especially in the north and east, where skies stayed clearer for longer. To the south and west, clouds have been increasing and kept readings a little warmer. These clouds will overspread more of the area this morning and afternoon as time goes on. Areas of showers and storms within them also affecting parts of the area. Some of this possible south of I-80 this morning, with activity potentially spreading as far north as U.S. Highway 20 corridor by mid-afternoon. Temperatures today reach the 60s, with readings closer to 60 where clouds and potential rain will be present, and the warmest readings in the north in the mid-60s, with more sun for longer this morning. Showers and storms become more widespread tonight after about 7 to 9 o'clock p.m. These will likely set up in a band from west to east between Interstate 80 and Highway 20, providing renewed development in the same areas throughout the night. This could lead to heavier rainfall totals of an inch or more, with localized areas receiving 2 inches or more. This continues into the morning hours of Thursday, so expect a wet start to your day on Thursday. Areas south of Highway 20 may catch a bit of a break from showers and storms for parts of Thursday, as the warm front that is serving as the focus for this activity moves far enough north. Temperatures will once again reach the 60s for those that see some dry time, with 50s likely north of 20, where rain is more likely. Another round of showers and storms is likely to develop to our west on Thursday evening, moving into eastern Iowa at night. These storms could again carry some heavy downpours, but they should be relatively quick-moving in any one area. Lows only fall into the 50s during this time. Additional showers and storms are possible on Friday, with a few strong ones possible if we are able to see any sort of clearing between morning showers and storms and any afternoon redevelopment. We'll be watching this potential closely. Otherwise, temperatures will vary quite a bit as the low passes right over the area, with low 50s in the north and readings closer to 70 in the south. The net result of all these shower and storm chances is some potentially substantial rainfall totals, especially given the dry year we've had so far. An inch or more is pretty likely, with areas north of Interstate 80 the most likely to wind up with totals even higher than that in the 2 to 3 inch range. Not everyone is guaranteed that higher end amount, but it's best shot we've had at rainfall of that amount in a long while. Due to the prolonged nature of the event, flash flooding isn't very likely, but we'll be watching for any areas that see repeated activity in a shorter time. The weekend kicks off with a cool, cloudy, blustery, and potentially showery day on Saturday, with highs only in the 50s. Similarly, cool weather sticks around on Sunday, but with drier conditions generally, and maybe even a bit of sunshine at times. Temperatures slowly warm toward the upper 50s or near 60 by the middle of next week, with a few showers possible at the tail end of the 9-day forecast on next Thursday. Now let's turn to the sports page. Now we begin with UNI college football. Ahead of SDSU game, UNI needs to meet its standard. Story written by Ethan Petrick. Dateline, Cedar Falls. The Northern Iowa defense played, quote, good on Saturday in a 27-20 road win over Indiana State as the Panthers maintained their unblemished record in Missouri Valley Football Conference play. Looking back on a game in which the Sycamores played keep away from the Panthers, Panthers head football coach Mark Farley said on Monday he saw a resilient Panthers team led by running back Harrison Baybui and tight end Lane Pryor. Quote, we had great resilience throughout that whole thing, Farley said. Quote, I felt we did some really good things. Harrison ran really well. I thought he was the difference in the football game. He and Lane Pryor, their energy, their toughness that they displayed that day was really what stood out the most and what carried the day for us, unquote. Farley also added that the Panthers' offense showed resiliency with a balanced attack that leaned more heavily on its ground game for the second consecutive week, racking up 148 rushing yards and 3 rushing touchdowns. Quote, they have done some good things, Farley said, as far as being behind and then going out there after we had a lead or taken a lead, something like that. Some adversity has hit, and then they come right back and get the points back. I see consistency after some things that have gone on throughout the game. From start to finish, they are doing a nice job of adjusting, and as we go through a game, to keep creating opportunities to score, unquote. However, Farley said he also saw a need for his defense to be something more. He needed to see his defense provide a better complement to his offense. Quote, that is where complementary football is, Farley said. Quote, is making sure you get the ball back for your offense. You get them in good field position. We did that at times on defense. We kept them under 100 yards rushing. We still need to take away some of the explosive plays on defense. Even the defense, I would say, played a good, but to our standard, needed to play better, unquote. Following the win on Saturday, linebacker Tucker Langenberg provided the same sentiments as Farley would offer on Monday. Quote, we have our fair share of things to fix, Langenberg said. Defense as a whole, we have to come up and we have to wrap up. That is the ultimate goal. It's nice when you can get 3 and outs. Tonight, obviously, it was kind of ugly. The other routes were killing us. But we got the job done. That's all that matters. Quote, they were nickel and diming us in the flat. You have to tighten up coverage. We started out the game. We were a little loose. We did not really show up until the second quarter. So we have to tighten stuff up, unquote. The Panthers held the Sycamores to 96 rushing yards, to be exact, though 4 sacks cost Indiana State ground game 25 yards in the game. Through the air, Indiana State quarterback Cade Chambers went 23 of 30 for 245 yards with 1 touchdown and 2 interceptions. From a production standpoint, the UNI defense did what it needed to do to hinder the Sycamores' offense. The possession numbers tell a different story. Indiana State won the possession battle over the Panthers. With 39 minutes and 58 seconds of possession time, compared to just over 20 minutes for UNI. Indiana State's keep-away game plan was nothing new. The Sycamores used the same script last season in the Unidome, outpossessing UNI. Both games ended as Panthers defense came up with an interception in the final minute on a potential game-tying drive. The obvious effectiveness of the game plan, a keep UNI quarterback Theo Day and offense coordinator Bodie Reeder out of the equation plan, makes it seem ripe for copying for other conference foes as UNI readies for its final 6 games against 3 ranked opponents and 1 in receiving votes category. Farley cast doubt on the possibility that any of the Panthers' remaining regular season opponents could copy the Sycamores' playbook, but did not eliminate the possibility with a date against number 1, South Dakota State, looming this weekend. Quote, if you have to have the right kind of team to do that, and if you have to have the right kind of patience to do that, Farley said. Quote, it was their way of doing things. It was their passing game that kind of, they built a plan around their players that they recruited. So I do not know if there will be any other MVC teams. It could be. Quote, we have to get our feet underneath us today, figure out what the plan is, and then move from there. Under the injury report, Farley did not provide an update on injuries to running back Ty Edwards or linebacker Ben Belkin on Monday. Both Edwards and Belkin left the win over Indiana State during the first half and did not return to play. Linebacker Josiah Galvin exited in the fourth quarter with an injury, but returned later on the same drive. Now in high school volleyball, big time transformation. Pop turns into force at pin position for Tigers. This story was written by Ethan Petrick and begins with a photograph showing Cedar Falls senior Paige Pop as she strikes an attack against Center Point Urbana on Saturday in Center Point. Dateline Cedar Falls. Matt Johnson still finds it hard to believe. Sitting in the gym at the Creighton University team volleyball camp in Omaha in the middle of July, the Cedar Falls head coach saw something he never expected heading into the 2023 season. We went to Creighton for a team camp in mid-July, Johnson said. It is kind of a stress-free environment to throw people out and see how well they do. I remember calling back to Adam Timmons, because Adam was back in Cedar Falls after day one. Quote, I said, you are not going to believe what you're going to see when we get into the fall in the gym, unquote. 2 months after that, Johnson still used unbelievable to describe the transformation of senior outside hitter Paige Pop into a force at the pins for the Tigers. Quote, she has made an unbelievable improvement for her junior year to her senior year, Johnson said. Quote, some of that is confidence. She had a great track season, and I think that helped her confidence-wise. Some of it is she is an extremely coachable kid. Quote, I have never seen a kid go from fighting for a spot as a junior to being probably a first-team all-stater as a senior, unquote. During her junior season, Pop, the youngest child alongside her twin sister Lauren, of Northern Iowa defensive line coach and former NFL Defensive Player of the Year, Bryce Pop, appeared in 17 matches, starting 10 for the Tigers, and recorded 41 kills. It took her 4 matches to exceed her total production from 2022 in her senior season. Through 20 matches played and 20 started, Pop leads the Tigers with 273 kills on a 271 hitting efficiency. The stats do not do justice to the player Pop has become for the Tigers. Quote, it was just kind of everything, Johnson said. What you see is she is jumping high and she is swinging hard, but she is passing well, she is defending well, she is serving a tough ball. She has just worked on her game and you can see it in all aspects, unquote. A 6-rotation asset. Pop routinely takes over sets for the Tigers. In a match against Wallert Catholic earlier this season, which the Tigers won via sweep, Pop played her abilities with an individual run of 6 kills to seal the win over the Golden Eagles in the final set of the match. According to Pop, she entered her senior year determined to be a factor. Quote, I wanted to go out and have fun and be the best player I can be, Pop said. I want to be the best player I can be and the best player for my team. I really wanted to play a lot this year. Though she credits her step up to spending more time in the weight room, Pop added that her track season helped, as speculated by Johnson. Pop qualified for state in the 100-meter hurdles, placing 19th with a time of 15.86. According to Pop, her time on Jim Duncan track in Drake Stadium allowed her to overcome some trepidation on the court. Quote, "It got me ready for big events," Pop said. "I can handle the pressure now. Before, I was all scared, but now I can handle it." Quote, "Last year, I was really scared, like very tense. This year, I am just going out and playing my game and seeing how good I can be. I felt like I could not make a mistake, but this year I was like, I have to do my best," unquote. Looking back at the Creighton team camp, Pop indicated she knew she could accomplish her goals. Quote, "I knew I was going to be better than last year," Pop said, "but not this good," unquote. With Pop leading the way, the Tigers climbed to number 4 in Class 5A in the last Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union volleyball rankings. However, it has not been a one-woman show. With Katie Remmert's graduation after the 2022 season, Johnson said the Tigers knew they needed someone to step up, and they knew they needed to be more balanced, as Remmert's 387 kills in 2022 accounted for 33.2% of Cedar Falls' total production. The Tigers have found that balance in 2023. Quote, "People were going to have to step forward," Johnson said. "Paige sometimes steals the show because she gets that run of all of a sudden 5 or 6 kills on an 8-point stretch. But Grace Hannon, as the year goes on, her hitting percentage is creeping up. Kaya Bradfield is being more of an option. We knew we were asking Natalie Schmendecki. She sets a lot for her club team. So we asked her to do something a little out of position. You can see she is just starting to get more comfortable." Quote, "We are getting to the point in the season where we need more out of everybody, and everybody is giving us a little more," unquote. Now let's read some stories from the front page of the Courier today. Harvest is progressing, and the weather is fine. The story begins with a photograph of a John Deere combine in a big cloud of dust, and the caption says, "A farmer harvests soybeans on a farm south of Waterloo on Thursday." Dateline Des Moines. Western Iowa was the recipient of above-average precipitation last week. However, the state still had 5.9 days suitable for field work during the week, ending Sunday. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service, corn and soybean harvest continued to be the primary field activities for the week. Quote, "Harvest is in full swing. Warmer temperatures and mostly dry conditions across the state allowed for significant harvest progress in the past week," said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nag. Quote, "Forecasts are highlighting the chances of widespread rainfall statewide this week, potentially keeping combines out of the fields for a few days later this week." In the weather summary, the first week of October remained unseasonably warm, though temperatures took a nosedive toward the end of the reporting period. The statewide average temperature was 60.3 degrees, 5.7 degrees above normal. Western Iowa received above-average rainfall totals, with unseasonably dry conditions continuing across Iowa's eastern two-thirds, according to Justin Glisson, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Iowa flags at half-staff to honor slain Israelis. Story written by Caleb McCullough. And the dateline is Courier Des Moines Bureau in Des Moines. Governor Kim Reynolds, who has worked to strengthen ties between Iowa and Israel in recent years, ordered flags at half-staff in Iowa on Monday to honor the lives lost in the deadly attack in Israel by Hamas militants over the weekend. Quote, "Iowans mourn for the families of those killed by Hamas in Israel. Hamas's brutality knows no bounds, with reports of Holocaust survivors, women and children, taken by Hamas militants from their homes as hostages or brutally murdered," Reynolds said in a statement Monday. Quote, "Today and every day, Iowa stands in solidarity with Israel and their right to defend themselves," unquote. The conflict in Israel and Gaza unfolded after the Palestinian militant group Hamas launched an unprecedented surprise attack on Israel on Saturday. Israel has responded with rocket strikes in the blockaded Gaza Strip. More than 1,300 people had been killed as of Monday, including at least 9 Americans, according to reports. Flags will be flown at half-staff on public buildings and businesses, and individuals are encouraged to fly flags at half-staff until October 15th. Strengthen ties. Reynolds has worked to nurture Iowa's relationship with Israel, dating back to before her time as governor. In 2016, she joined a Republican Lieutenant Governors Association delegation to the country with her counterparts from Texas, Florida, and other states. Then in 2017, after assuming the role of governor, Reynolds led a trade mission to Israel to develop business opportunities for Israeli companies in Iowa. Reynolds went on another international trade mission in June of this year that included a visit to Israel and a discussion with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In a statement at the time, Reynolds' office said she and Netanyahu discussed strengthening economic ties between the two governments. Quote, Israel's vigilant pursuit of freedom and security in a hostile world powerfully demonstrates the remarkable fortitude of the Israeli people, Reynolds said in a statement in June. Quote, I believe there is great opportunity for further economic partnership in the fields of insurance and agriculture, industries in which Israel and Iowa both excel, unquote. Reynolds signed a proclamation of support for Israel on the 75th anniversary of its establishment as an independent nation and participated in a wreath-laying ceremony at Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance Center in Jerusalem. She also met with Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Minister of Strategic Affairs, her office said. Shortly after Reynolds' visit this year, 7 Israeli agriculture startups participated in a program through America's Cultivation Corridor, sponsored by the Iowa Economic Development Authority, to prepare them to enter the American market. Quote, this course, led by food and ag industry and research leadership, is a great opportunity to establish the right connections for businesses to scale into the U.S. system, Reynolds said in August. Quote, from my recent travels to Israel, it is great to see the continuation of our conversations through programs like this, and we look forward to companies continuing to build their connections here, unquote. Reynolds and Iowa lawmakers have also strengthened Iowa's rejection of companies that boycott Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories. In 2022, lawmakers extended a previously existing law barring the state from investing in companies that boycott Israel and take part in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. The original investment ban was signed in 2016 by then-Governor Terry Branstad, as several other states around the nation were enacting similar laws. The 2022 law changed the wording to also ban state investments in wholly owned subsidiaries that boycott Israel. The legislation was seen by Democrats as specifically targeting the Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream Company, a subsidiary of Unilever. Lawmakers paired that with a bill that defined anti-Semitism in Iowa law and encouraged the state to consider anti-Semitism with investigating a discriminatory act. Quote, today, we expressed Iowa's enduring support for the state of Israel and our categorical rejection of anti-Semitism, Reynolds said in a press release when she signed both bills into law. Quote, together, these bills send an important message. Iowa continues to stand shoulder to shoulder with the state of Israel, one of America's most important and reliable allies, while fighting all forms of religious and ethnic discrimination, unquote. Cedar Falls Clinic finds ways to help LGBTQ plus pediatric patients. Story written by Maria Cooper. and the dateline is Cedar Falls. No longer able to provide gender-affirming care to minors, one medical clinic has partnered with out-of-state doctors' offices to give patients the care they need. On September 18th, Senate File 538 forced the Unity Point LGBTQ clinic in Cedar Falls to stop providing puberty blockers, hormones, and surgeries to treat gender dysphoria for those under 18. Health providers are still able to see LGBTQ children in their offices, but cannot use these treatments. Medical professionals who violate the law could be subject to discipline from a state licensing board. Individuals can bring lawsuits against doctors who continue providing gender-affirming care. To still help patients seeking care, Rachel Benson, a medical provider at the clinic, is referring children and their families to out-of-state clinics. Benson said she is thankful because 13 clinics in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois have stepped up to partner with her office. 9 of those clinics are through the University of Minnesota Hospitals and Clinics, which are mostly near the Twin Cities, about a 3-hour drive from the Cedar Valley. Quote, "We are very grateful for all of these clinics able and willing to help us, especially because care of the patient is the first and most important thing," Benson said. Quote, "We want to make sure the patients get the care they need to help prevent detrimental outcomes when they can't seek gender-affirming care," unquote. The Trevor Project, a nonprofit that focuses on suicide prevention in the LGBTQ community, said transgender and non-binary children are 2 to 2.5 times more likely to experience depressive symptoms, seriously consider suicide, and attempt suicide compared with their cisgender peers. The organization also found that 45% of LGBTQ youth seriously considered attempting suicide in the past year, including more than half of transgender and non-binary children. Benson said before the law passed in March, Dr. Carl Christensen, who runs the clinic along with his wife Jen, prepared for changes by sending out feelers to other clinics and writing referrals for patients. Quote, "I know Minnesota was marked a safe state," Benson said, referencing Governor Tim Walz signing an executive order to protect rights to gender-affirming care. Quote, "So we leaned into that because they would likely be able to have care and not have the ban happen to them," unquote. In the weeks since the law went into effect, Benson said she has seen a stark decrease in the amount of pediatric patients at the clinic. Quote, "I would hope it's because of the work we did to help prepare patients to move care out of state, instead of them now being afraid to seek care," she said. Bremer County to take on $4.7 million for emergency communication upgrade. Story filed by Andy Malone, and the dateline is Waverly. Bremer County will sell up to $4.7 million in general obligation bonds for an overhaul of its obsolete emergency communication infrastructure and equipment. The Board of Supervisors voted unanimously to issue the bonds as part of the financing for what Bremer County Sheriff Dan Pickett says is a little more than a $5 million undertaking. The board did not need to go to voters for a referendum because the upgrade is deemed part of an essential service. Quote, "It's an essential service because it is needed for the safety of everybody and all first responders. This is so police, fire, and EMS can talk to each other," said Pickett. Officials hosted public meetings to inform residents of the impending debt. Officials reported hearing from a substantial number of people in favor, but none openly against the measure. Quote, "Supervisors said if we're the people voting on it, we want people to know about it," said Pickett. The debt will result in the average county portion of the property tax bill being $38.80 more per $100,000 of property valuation each year over the 5 years it will be paid off. The balance of the cost is being covered from the county's available pool of 911 surcharge rate funds collected over several years, said Pickett. Supervisors entered into an agreement with Motorola Solutions Incorporated to carry out the improvements starting in 2024, scheduled to wrap up in the middle of 2025, that will allow first responders to access the Iowa statewide interoperable communication system. The money will go toward a number of improvements, including upgrades to the interior of the structurally sound communication tower first responders utilize in Sumner, and two new dispatch communication consoles there. The agreement also will provide new radios within each emergency vehicle and portable radios for all law enforcement officers, as well as a limited number for fire and EMS operations. Quote, each individual department would not have the money to do every truck and do every portable on their own, said Pickett. And if we didn't do anything, we'd be stuck in a bit of an island, unquote. He said that's because surrounding counties have taken on similar projects and are utilizing different communication systems and frequency than Bremer County is now. And now, listeners, we'd just like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 11th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped.
I might not know you, but I still care about you. So if you feel hopeless or if you've been thinking about suicide, please talk to someone. A friend, parent, teacher, or coworker. If you can't talk to them or feel like you have no one there to listen, turn to Your Life Iowa. Things can get better. There are people who want to help you. Please reach out now at yourlifeiowa.org. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from Alan Gubert. A giant of the Green Revolution dies. And it's under the heading Food and Farm File. One of the last giants of the 1960s and 1970s Green Revolution, M.S. Swaminathan, died at his home in Chennai, India, on September 28th. He was 98. Swaminathan was to India what Norman Borlaug, the Iowa farm boy turned Nobel Peace Prize winner, was to the rest of the hungry post-World War, a brilliant hands-on scientist whose work saved untold millions, maybe billions, from lives of poverty and starvation. Quote, if Borlaug was the way, I wrote in this space after 2004 visit to Chennai, Swaminathan was the means, because he had turned India's centuries empty begging bowl into an overflowing breadbasket, unquote. It didn't happen overnight. Swaminathan invited Borlaug to India in 1963 to tour farms. Shortly thereafter, the two collaborated to develop wheat and rice varieties to replace less hardy, more vulnerable varieties used by Indian subsistence farmers at the time. By 1974, noted the New York Times in Swaminathan's obituary, India was self-sufficient in wheat and rice. By 1982, wheat production had reached almost 40 million metric tons, more than triple the harvest in the early 1960s. By comparison, U.S. wheat production this year will total around 47 million metric tons. Another important U.S. link was Swaminathan being named the first World Food Prize laureate in 1987, an award envisioned by Borlaug. The already famous Indian used the then $200,000 prize money to establish the M.S. Swaminathan Research Foundation in Chennai to assist women and rural development. But its impact was intended to go even deeper. The welcoming Swaminathan explained in our visit almost two decades ago. The foundation hopes, quote, to harness science and technology for an environmentally sustainable and socially equitable job-led economic growth of India's rural areas, unquote. People first, technology second, he said, adding, quote, first the green revolution, then the evergreen revolution, unquote. Always the searcher, Swaminathan asked almost as many questions as were asked of him. Many centered on the relatively new genetically modified corn and soybean seeds, sweeping American farms at the time. Surprisingly, the renowned geneticist wasn't a big supporter. Like many others, especially the Europeans, Swaminathan worried about food safety, intellectual property rights, and if, quote, the technology will increase the rich-poor divide. His point was short and sharp. Technologies that compound social problems are not needed, unquote. That didn't mean all GM technology was bad, he added. It did, however, mean there was a division to maintain. Quote, GM seeds that did not make an investment in the livelihoods of the poor, he said, are unwelcome, unquote. For example, his foundation's researchers had isolated the gene that allows mangrove trees to thrive in salt marshes. That gene was then introduced to rice because he believes salt-tolerant crops will play an increasingly important role as global warming impacts developing nations' future food supplies, unquote. He, like Borlaug, wasn't aiming for sainthood. Indeed, his detractors say his list of sins was far too long to earn him a halo. The biggest, say environmental groups both here and in India, was his encouraging industrial farm practices that relied on expensive and polluting fertilizers and pesticides, and for supporting the development of genetically modified crops, explained the Times obituary. Guilty as charged, I suspect the easy-to-smile scientist might plead for two clearly redemptive reasons. First, Swaminathan, quote, came of age amid one of the worst disasters to strike India in the 20th century, noted the Washington Post on September 28th. The Bengal famine of 1943, estimated to have killed 3 million people, unquote. The youth who had planned to follow his father into medicine, quote, set aside those plans to study agriculture after witnessing the agony of famine. So forget the hardened critics. That is proper sainthood material. And second, Swaminathan, like Borlaug, and every farmer whose ag roots reach back even one generation, are swimming in the same vat of 1960s techno-guilt, because no one, not even the venerable Borlaug, could know just how much environmental and cultural change accompanied the genius of those magical, life-saving crops. We do know now, however, and the moral challenge we face is to stop blaming Borlaug and Swaminathan for yesterday's sins and start accepting responsibility for ours today. Next, we have Steve Corbin, who is included as a guest columnist in the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. The title of his opinion piece is The GOP War to Cancel Woke Culture. Charlie Chaplin once said, quote, a day without laughter is a day wasted, unquote. Life around my dad, Lester, was filled with jokes, teasing, and what became known as Lesterisms. Raised around the humor of Red Skelton, Red Fox, Jonathan Winters, Rodney Dangerfield, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Laurel and Hardy, plus a subscription to Mad Magazine, I was programmed to seek out laughter. If those comedians were living, their take on the GOP's recent cancel woke culture war would even make card-carrying Republicans laugh. There are over 400 companies, products, and individuals GOP party leaders are calling to be canceled, i.e. boycotted, because they either questioned Donald Trump's leadership or took a stance on racism, sexuality, gender, race, diversity, equity, inclusion, social injustices, wellness, and life balance that counters Republican views. Here are a few examples. United, American, and Delta Airlines canceled. Avis, Budget, Enterprise, and Hertz Car Rental canceled. McDonald's, Starbucks, Chick-fil-A, Cracker Barrel, Golden Corral, Taco Bell, IHOP, and Red Lobster canceled. Sports lovers, NFL, NBA, and MLB canceled. HBO and Netflix canceled. French fries, yes, French fries, canceled. Harley Davidson, couldn't be, canceled. Hershey, Procter & Gamble, Kellogg's, Nabisco, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi-Cola, canceled. You've got to do an internet search on list of things conservatives have canceled, as well as Nebraska Taxpayers for Freedom. Guaranteed you'll laugh. It's ironic the Republican Party purports to believe in free enterprise, yet is opposed to corporations pro-environmental, pro-social, and pro-governance, woke factors of running a successful business. Plus, GOP candidates must be oblivious to the fact that the majority of registered Republicans support corporations' environmental, social, and governance endeavors. Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines woke as being aware of and actively attentive to important facts and issues, especially issues of racial and social justice. Being woke is about being alert to racial prejudice and discrimination, being vigilant toward social issues, and challenging opposition. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter," unquote. Racial and social justice issues matter. For this reason alone, there is a compelling case to be woke and choose growth. The younger strata of America, millennials ages 27 to 42, and Generation Z ages 11 to 26, are America's most pro-woke, culturally aware group fighting for social justice, equal rights, and equal opportunity. They are the most active social media users who readily broadcast their fight against injustice, intolerance, and discrimination. Finally, millennials are the largest electorate population, and Gen Z voter turnout in 2022 was higher than that of Gen Xers, 43 to 48 age range, and millennials. Logic reasons that with the Republican Party touting its cancel woke culture belief, more young voters will purposely avoid GOP candidates in the 2024 election. Voters older than 42 will soon, if not already, also rebel against the GOP's cancel woke culture folly. What Republican presidential candidates support the cancel woke culture and aren't grasping issues like gender pay gap, gender discrimination, racial inequality, racial injustice, LGBTQIA rights, sexual harassment, sexual assault, environmental and climate change, First Amendment rights, Nazi-like book banning, fair voter registration, and unencumbered voting opportunity? They include former President Donald Trump, former Vice President Mike Pence, Governor Ron DeSantis, Governor Doug Burgum, former Governor Nikki Haley, Senator Tim Scott, and Vivek Ramaswamy. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has rejected his GOP peers' cultural war rhetoric. The GOP's 2020 presidential election campaign had no platform, and we saw how that worked out. The Republicans' 2024 cancel woke culture platform, which only 24% of Republican voters support, will be quite the joke come November 5th, 2024. Americans must be compassionately woke to racial and social justice issues. Otherwise, you must be asleep. Are you woke or asleep? The author here, Steve Corbin, is an emeritus professor of marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. Next, from the New York Times, Trump uses support for Israel to revive travel ban talk. His remarks echoed the type of anti-Muslim rhetoric that he successfully tapped into during his 2016 presidential run. written by Anjali Hayoun. Former President Donald J. Trump, while addressing the fighting in Israel on Monday, attempted to stoke fear of attacks taking place on U.S. soil and suggested that a travel ban, like the one he implemented as president, could stop such violence. Mr. Trump's comments at a campaign rally in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, echoed the anti-Muslim rhetoric that he successfully tapped during his 2016 presidential run, harnessing sentiments that have lingered in the post-9/11 era. While discussing a series of surprise attacks launched over the weekend by Hamas, the Palestinian militant group that controls the Gaza Strip, Mr. Trump promised to, quote, stand strongly with the state of Israel, unquote, and said to cheers that he had imposed a strict travel ban to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States. He called to reimpose the travel ban on terror-afflicted countries, unquote. Quote, the bloodshed and killing that we saw this week will never, ever be allowed to happen on American soil, he said. Quote, except for the fact that we have now allowed tens of thousands of probable terrorists into our country, unquote. He claimed, without evidence, that the same people that attacked Israel are entering the United States through its southern border, a similar message asserted by at least two other Republican presidential candidates, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and Vivek Ramaswamy, over the weekend. During his 2016 campaign, Mr. Trump called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. The order that his administration imposed shortly after taking office in 2017 banned travel into the United States for people from seven countries, most of them predominantly Muslim, though the order went through several iterations that changed the final list of countries. Iran, one of the affected countries, has funded Hamas. Mr. Trump earlier revived discussions of a travel ban in July, saying in Iowa that he would impose a travel ban, quote, even bigger than before, unquote. Now we have a piece written by David French, which was printed in the New York Times. The title is The Hidden Moral Injury of OK Boomer. Mourners gathered around San Francisco City Hall this week to remember Senator Dianne Feinstein, one of the most formidable politicians of her generation. Her passing meant not just the end of her political career, but also the end of a furious argument over her age and condition. Why did she stay in the Senate for so long? And even so, as one argument ends, others continue, about Joe Biden, Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, and many others. I can't remember the last time our country had a longer or more agonizing conversation about age. It kicked off in the most morally troubling ways possible, in the early days of the pandemic, when a number of politicians, celebrities, and even ordinary people minimized the severity of the disease in language that diminished the value of older Americans. Notoriously, in March 2020, Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, went on Tucker Carlson's television show and suggested that senior citizens should be willing to take a chance on their survival to preserve the American economy. In New York, nursing home deaths were deliberately concealed, an act that publicly minimized the magnitude of the loss. The right-wing influencer Candace Owens dismissed the seriousness of COVID because, in her words, quote, people think it's novel that 80-year-olds are dying at a high rate from a flu, unquote. I heard similar sentiments from members of my own community throughout the lockdowns. I can't tell you how many times someone said when an older person died, quote, how much time did they have left anyway, unquote. This debate unfolded as the term OK Boomer was taking off, both as a silly mockery of tech-ignorant grandparents and an angry battle cry against an older generation that younger Americans believe failed them. Worse still, they just won't get out of the way. It's impossible to ignore the advanced age of key American leaders. Joe Biden is 80. Donald Trump is 77. Mitch McConnell is 81. Chuck Grassley is 90. Feinstein was 90 when she died in office. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was 87. Age was on 76-year-old Mitt Romney's mind when he announced that he wouldn't seek re-election to the Senate. Quote, "At the end of another term, I'd be in my mid-80s. Frankly, it's time for a new generation of leaders," he said. I don't equate all these situations. Some of the sentiments expressed at the start of the pandemic were monstrous. Concerns about aging and often infirm leaders at the highest level of American politics, in all three branches of government, are far more understandable and much less grotesque than asking senior citizens to court death in the midst of a pandemic. The generational dismissiveness inherent in OK Boomer lies somewhere in between. Nonetheless, there is a common theme, a shift to viewing older people in America not as assets, but rather as obstacles. They're barriers to our own dreams and ambitions. One column is insufficient for teasing out all the reasons for this shift, but I want to explore one aspect that bothers me greatly: the centrality of work and career to our sense of self and identity, especially in America's educated classes, is damaging old and young alike. In 2019, Derek Thompson popularized the term workism in The Atlantic to describe how our careers have morphed into a religious identity. Earlier this year, he summed up the history of work like this: from jobs to careers to callings. In January, the Pew Research Center released a startling report describing parents' priorities for their children. An extraordinary 88% said that financial independence was extremely or very important. The same percentage placed the same priority on their kids having careers they enjoy. In contrast, only 21% said it was extremely or very important for their children to get married. A mere 20% said it was extremely or very important for their kids to have children. Workism tells older Americans who might think otherwise that their job is core to who they are. Likewise, workism tells younger Americans that their job will define them. It is core to who they're becoming. Read in this way, it's easy to see why older Americans are reluctant to simply step aside. If they feel able, and it's easier to feel able when your job centers on your mind rather than your body, then the demand to leave is an attack on their essential identity. But just as older Americans can have an obligation to let go of professions and power, young Americans can have obligations to hold on to their elders, to treasure them rather than shove them aside. And what duties do we owe to the older people in our lives? The Catechism outlines a beautiful balance. We are called to the defense and maintenance of their persons and authority, at the same time that we are bearing with their infirmities and covering them in love. In a true ethic of respect and care, the spirit of OK Boomer is nowhere to be found. The Mitt Romney Christmas card is legendary in some niche circles in Washington. Every December, he sends out a simple picture of his growing family. You can Google it and see it expand year by year. First, he and his five sons could field a Romney basketball team. Then, when the sons married and had children, they could field a Romney football team. But that picture is also a declaration. This is who I am. Skeptics might claim that Romney let go of his power because holding it would be hard. In these polarized times, he was vulnerable to a challenge from the Utah right. Perhaps, but it's also true that he retains immense purpose, and the picture captures that purpose. An ethos that locates our meaning in those relationships can tell the young to value the wisdom and experience of the old, and tell our nation's older generations that great blessings can flow from the end of even the most rewarding careers. Linden United Methodist Church to host Craft Bazaar. Dateline Waterloo. A craft bazaar is happening from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on October 14th at the Linden United Methodist Church, located at 301 Butler Avenue. The event benefits mission projects, Midwest Missions, and OCC shoeboxes, Halloween, Christmas, fall, winter, and other miscellaneous crafts will be available. A bake sale and breakfast also will be offered. Charge dismissed after Iowa senator arrested during ragbri in Sac County. Dateline Sac City, Iowa. A criminal charge has been dropped against an Iowa legislator who was accused of refusing to obey a Sac County law enforcement officer's orders during ragbri's swing through the county. Magistrate Joshua Walsh on Friday dismissed a simple misdemeanor charge of interference with official acts filed against State Senator Adrian Dickey. Sac County Attorney Ben Smith had moved for dismissal, saying in his motion he did not believe there was enough evidence to prove the charge beyond a reasonable doubt, and that it was in the best interest of justice to dismiss the case. Dickey, 49, a Republican from Packwood, who represents District 44 in southeast Iowa, was arrested July 24th near Carnarvon, where a big party had stopped in the middle of the road. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, October 11th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.